Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
The main thing, I guess, that's been going on is the Mobile World Conference, which is this event that happens usually in Barcelona every year. And it's when all the mobile phone companies bring out and announce their new toys. Interestingly enough, Samsung did not announce its brand new smartphone because it's now having to play catch up, having had to pull one version of its flagship. It's now taking its time. So that will be a few more months. But we had the launch of the Nokia 3310 Mark II. For those that aren't old enough, the Nokia 3310 was a little phone launched in the year 2000, some 17 years ago, and it was much loved because it was probably the first mobile phone that many of us owned, because I think they sold 126 million of these things, which is, just to put that in some sort of context, is about, well, it's more than, say, the first four generations of iPhone sold put together. So people like these little phones. They had a lot going for them. And the company that now makes Nokia phones, which, by the way, is not Nokia, decided that they were going to go all retro on us, and they produced a version of this thing, and they announced it at the Mobile World Conference. And it's kind of special. It has a lot of, it's a basic phone. It's not a smartphone. It's what they call a feature phone, or if you like, a dumb phone, but no one uses quite that expression anymore. But it's good for people, for example, that may be confused by or don't need the extra functionality of having a sort of mobile computer in your pocket. It's got battery life that goes much longer than a smartphone would go, so it would give you about a month on standby or 22 hours of talk time. It's a very tough little phone. There was a sort of joke in the industry, which was that if you drop a smartphone on the floor, you break the screen.
Yeah.
If you drop a Nokia 3310 on the floor, you break the floor. And it's probably not far off the truth. No. Plus, it had this game that it was the first game that a lot of us ever played on a smartphone, which was called Snake. Mm. And Snake is back. I mean, it's had a bit of a lick of paint, but it's back. They've improved the battery life. I mean, it's a nice little phone. It's I think they've said it's going to be about €50, so sadly, that will probably end up being nearer £50 over here. But, you know, it's interesting that they did that. They launched at the same time, under the Nokia brand, three Android phones, the Nokia 3, the Nokia 5, and the Nokia 6. There's no Nokia 4 because 4 is an unlucky number, I understand, in China, so there's no Nokia 4. But they wouldn't have got much media attention if they'd just done that, because you know, it's another Android phone, who cares, sort of thing. But because they did this thing with the Nokia 3310, they got a lot of attention, I think rightly so.
And are they going to be available in Europe, the Nokia phones?
Yeah they will be. So Nokia, they are going to be available. Effectively, the Nokia brand is kind of coming back, and it's a bit complicated, but it's made by, they're now made by a company called, well, the brand is owned by a company called HMD Global, who, by the way, employ a number of people who used to be very high up inside Nokia. So there's kind of that Nokia spirit lives on in HMD Global. But the actual manufacturing, interestingly, is done by a company called Foxconn, who also make iPhones for Apple. In fact, they make a lot of stuff. So the quality, hopefully, should be there. And I don't know, I think the Nokia name is you know, just like the 3310 was loved, I think a lot of people remember the Nokia name very well. Before the world got hit by smartphones, Nokias were known as the phones that were not only good phones, but easy to use. You know, the software inside them was easy to use. And these still share that benefit. And I think there is this sort of retro thing going on these days with, you know, people having vinyl and so forth. You know, we seem to be going back to our technological roots somehow.
Yeah, I do remember when I was in school, one of my friends had a Nokia 3310 and he desperately wanted a new phone. And so we spent the day trying to break it and failed miserably. We were throwing it at walls, we were standing on it in the school corridor. Nothing would break the blooming phone. It was hilarious. He was absolutely raging at the end of the day that he wasn't going to be getting a new phone. Right, 0500 909 699. 0818 96 96 93 is the number to call. And let's go to our first caller of the evening, who I believe is Dennis in London. Hello, Dennis.
Hi. Good morning.
How are you doing?
Very simple question for you guys. For me as a technophobe, absolutely insurmountable. I'm going on to the States for a 3-week holiday. I've got a few train journeys, few air journeys. Wanted to download some films, like I usually do. I got the iPad out, went to iTunes, went to order them. One of the movies is an old movie starring Rod Steiger called Hennessy, and the other one is a recent movie called The Siege of Jadeville, which is about Irish soldiers in the Congo, I think, and it was released last year. I couldn't get any of these movies, and I also got a very limited selection of action movies from iTunes. Have they sold out to Netflix or something, and is the only way I can get these movies to go to Netflix?
So, Dennis, good morning. No, they haven't sold out to anybody, but none of these online services, the libraries that they have at any given time, they do change from time to time what they offer, you know. Day by day, certain films come on board and others disappear. So it's not like you know, the British Library, where every book published is in there. There's no single repository that will have every film in it. So what we tend to do is look at different services. So you've mentioned you know, iTunes and the fact that they make films or movies available. You've got a service called Amazon Prime. So if you were already an Amazon Prime member, you could access their film library without paying. You've also, well, you mentioned Netflix, you've also got the fact that YouTube is there, and a lot of films actually appear on YouTube, not necessarily legally, so you'd have to check that it was there with the copyright owner's permission.
I am a member of Amazon Prime for my books, yeah?
Right. Well, if you're a member of Amazon Prime, so you pay a certain amount each year and you get next day delivery, is that right?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Is it just Amazon I'm a member of then?
As far as Amazon is concerned, and membership is concerned, you should be a member of Amazon Prime. However, all is not lost, because Amazon UK usually have a 30-day trial period, as do Netflix. So for these services, you could sign up a little bit before you leave for the 30-day trial, and then decide whether you want to keep the service. Obviously, if you don't want to keep the service...
So that's the way I go at that. It was just that the selection was so limited, as opposed to what I'd had in the future, in the past. I thought that maybe there'd been a change of policy at iTunes.
No. I mean, Dennis, to be frank with you, you can also have this problem even if you try and buy a DVD. Some films that have been out or were released a long time ago effectively get deleted.
Other one's a fairly recent release.
Right. No, I understand. And for that one, also bear in mind that it's not just streaming that's a possibility. You know, so you've got streaming films where you don't download the whole film, but it just gets passed down to your device as you're watching it. And you have potentially the ability to download as well. So sometimes films are available to stream but not to download, or vice versa. So unfortunately, you have to look if you're after specific films and they're not necessarily, you know, the most popular or best known films. Sometimes you do need to look across the different services. But
okay.
And Dennis, it looks like we've done a little bit of research on your behalf there, Dennis. It looks like Siege of Jadeville is actually a Netflix original production. So it looks like it might only be available on Netflix, that one. So that might help with that. But it is frustrating, isn't it, Fevzy, when you feel you have to subscribe to infinite numbers of services just to try and tick all the boxes of things you want to watch?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite often the case that you know, in tech, there's these competing camps, and none of them will offer you everything. Mm. It's like in the United States, different cable packages, and you can't necessarily get everything in one. And for example, the little set-top boxes that we use to stream video to, you know, make our dumb TVs into smart TVs. So you've got, you know, the Amazon Fire TV, but there are things that does that, for example, the Apple TV can do, and there's stuff that the Apple TV can do that the Roku 3 box can't do, that the Google stick can't do. So there are, none of them do everything. They overlap a lot. Mm. But they, in fact, that's not an accident. They all work very hard to have some unique content. And you mentioned there that, that, you know, that, that one of those titles was actually produced using Netflix's money. And that's what these services are starting to do now. Apple is just starting to do it. Netflix has been doing it for a while in the States. Hulu has been doing it for a long time as well. They produce their own content. And you're finding now that even TV series, is the series that get cancelled, let's say, by the BBC or what have you, the new series can be made by Netflix. And they stump up the money, and, you know, the world has changed, because now these geeky internet streaming companies are film producers and TV producers. They say content is king, and that's probably true. So the company that will offer the best choice, but still not everything, will probably do the best.
Yeah, I guess one of the saving graces of that as well is you can sort of you can drop in and out of these services, can't you? You can kind of subscribe for a month and then quite happily cancel your subscription and perhaps move your what you're paying for elsewhere to try and sort of catch up.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So for example, with Netflix, people might binge for a month and then come off for 2 months, and then. But it's also the case that, as I mentioned to Dennis, the offering changes, but it doesn't necessarily change very quickly. You'll get notices saying these films are about to, you know, cease to be available. So if you want to watch them, watch them. It's not necessarily worth being a member month after month after month once you've consumed the bulk of what you're interested in from the back library. It is sometimes worth coming off for a month or two and then back on, just to give things a time to refresh a little bit more.
Yeah, great. Dennis, thank you very much. Thanks for calling. It's 0500 909 693, or you can text us 85058. Fevzi, the gadget detective, is here to help with all your tech questions. One that's come in from Tony says, can Fevzi think of any dual SIM phone that when one SIM is switched off, the contacts on that SIM are hidden and so cannot be called or texted by accident? I've tried a few and none do this. Quite a basic need for a dual SIM phone, I would have thought. Smallish would be good too. Thank you. That's from Tony. What do you reckon, Fevzi?
Yeah, Tony, I don't think I've come across a dual SIM phone that has that functionality, because for the most part, people with dual SIM phones, what obviously it does vary, but for the most part, what people want to have is both SIM contacts available as and when they need them, and not to make them divided in that way. It's not a good thing to say, but the simplest way of achieving that is to buy a sort of a £15 second phone and deal with it that way. But it's very difficult to maintain that sort of division. I've never seen it, in fact. But if anyone knows that it exists, and, you know, obviously please call in. But as far as I'm aware, from all the dual SIM phones that I've personally tried, they don't do that. That's not the way they're structured.
Sure. Steve from Wigan's been in touch. He says, I have an Xperia U. I downloaded a new operating system, and over the last couple of months, I inadvertently picked up a virus. I've got a new SIM card. If there was a virus, can it be transferred via SIM to my new phone? And also, will a factory reset get rid of the virus?
Okay. It shouldn't be possible for the SIM card to act as a carrier of the virus across, because the data that is stored on SIM cards tends to be contact data and other static data. SIM cards generally don't hold program data, which is what a virus is. So it shouldn't be possible. That said, you should do everything that you can to rid your Xperia of that virus before you pop the SIM card back in. The Sony Xperias run the Android operating system, and what you need to do is make sure that you're putting back in the latest version of the Android operating system. So if there are any particular vulnerabilities, the latest one that your phone will support anyway. And yes, a full factory reset is the best way to go. It is possible for some viruses to survive a factory reset, but it's not likely. And to go any further down that avenue, you would have to identify what the virus was and do some research on that specific virus to see how you would make sure it was completely purge. But one good way of doing it is to actually reinstall Android, and in doing so, make sure you're reinstalling the latest version of the Android OS.
And is that relatively simple to do then, to kind of reinstall an operating system? It sounds quite intimidating at first.
Well, I mean, the most crucial part before you do anything like that is to make sure that you've got a complete backup of anything that you don't want to lose on your smartphone. So, you make sure you do that. Use the backup tools that are provided by Sony, when it goes well, updating an operating system is relatively straightforward. It can either be done what's called over the air by downloading it into the machine from its own internet connection, or you sometimes download it onto a computer and then transfer that across when the phone is docked to the computer. So there are different ways, again, specific to the device. I wouldn't say it's the easiest thing, and it's one of those things that if it went wrong, in the worst case, you can brick your phone, which means that the phone assumes the functionality of a brick. It stops being a phone and it becomes...
We don't mean a Nokia 3310 in that context, do we?
No. You know what? I own a phone called the Brick. I mean, really? talking of retro phones, a company called Binatone produced this, what I consider to be the ultimate retro phone, and it's called the Brick, and it's about 9 inches tall. It's about the size... It's a bit taller than a house brick, and has similar dimensions. It's got a big fat finger aerial sticking out the top of it, and I think it plays Snake. And it works as a phone, and you pull it out in a restaurant and people think, what? And, you know, it's quite useful if anyone tries to mug you on the way home. You've got a means of defending yourself. But it also doubles as a Bluetooth speaker.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of useful, even when the novelty of using it as a mobile phone has worn off. And it is I think it's a 2G mobile phone. So no real internet capability to speak of. But do you know what? With the larger battery, it's got a standby of 3 months.
Wow.
Which I think is the record for any sort of mobile phone, as far as I'm aware. So it's kind of, for those of us old enough to remember those sorts of phones, it harks back to the days when, people had car phones before they had mobile phones. In fact, there's a well-known warehouse named after, such a thing. The early phones, and I actually do remember this, it was a company phone, I remember, and it was the size of one of these bricks, and then there was a coil, and it went into a briefcase, which was the battery, and you'd have to carry around. It was more transportable than, personal device, but in its day, when we were used to ticker tape and floppy disks, I think, it was quite revolutionary, but... It's funny how things have changed, I guess.
Absolutely. Let's go to June in Leicester. Good morning, June.
Oh, good morning.
And what's your question for Febsy?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Well, I bought an Acer Chrome a couple of weeks ago. My printer didn't work, so I bought a new Canon wireless. Well, wasn't new, but it's a good one. And it is compatible because I rang them. But I can't attach it to my... I can't attach the printer to the Acer Chrome. I've tried everything for hours. And it tells me to download drivers and software, which I don't want to do. So I went back to the shop where I had it from, and they just told me to put in Google Print in. And I've tried everything. And what I want to know is, do I attach it through the printer, because it's a wireless one, or through the computer? Because it's got a window on the printer.
Right, okay, so this is...
And you,
yeah, I think so. And you're using a Chromebook. Is that what you're using, an Acer Chromebook?
Acer Chromebook, yeah.
Okay, Fevzy, how do you print from a Chromebook to the Canon printer?
And as I say, it is compatible because I rang them.
Yeah.
But I'm not paying £60 or £70 to have the technicians do it.
No, I mean, unfortunately, connecting printers... I mean, Chromebooks don't have the best compatibility, so it's worth checking again. So just probably worth taking a step back, June, and explaining. A Chromebook is usually a sort of fairly basic computer running the Chrome OS operating system, which is in essence a browser, and the programs that run are effectively running within the browser, and therefore once they're no longer online, the Chromebook, if the Chromebook is not online, it doesn't really have much in the way of useful functionality because everything's
run. I didn't realise that.
Yeah,
I've always had a Toshiba before. And I went for it, thought it would do with the job because it was a lot cheaper. But
Yeah. June, how long ago did you buy the Acer Chromebook?
About 3 weeks ago.
Okay. Did you buy it online or in a store?
No, I bought it from, I don't know if I can say the name. I bought it from Currys.
All right, okay. It troubles me that no one has explained to you the difference between a Chromebook and a normal...
I have been back to Currys.
Yeah.
And asked them why, and that he was the guy that told me all you have to put in is, I've written it down, Google printing.
Yeah.
But, and it'll do it, but it won't.
Yeah.
And it keeps saying my device is saved to Google Drive, but it won't take it.
Yeah. So June, I think we need to take one step back because the extent of your problems may not be the printer. If no one has explained to you and you haven't, with knowledge, chosen a Chromebook...
I am with you, yeah.
If you're used to, let's say, a Windows PC or an Apple Mac, those are so those are different types of programs where the operating system is installed on the machine and it runs locally and it can run irrespective of whether you've got an active internet connection. Chromebooks are designed to be cheap, simple to use and low maintenance, but they are not compatible with Windows PC, so you can't install programs, Windows software on it in the same way as you can on a Windows device and happily word process away. So the functionality they have without an active internet connection is limited, sometimes nil, it depends on the specific machine. I think if in the past you've owned a Windows computer, probably you're used to using particular Windows software, you're going to find the world very different because, as I say, all the software, which won't be the same as the Windows software, will run within a browser. And whilst it's better than it used to be and whilst it has a lot of advantages, so one of the advantages of a Chromebook, for instance, is maintenance. So you don't have to be continually patching and maintaining the operating system and the software on it because it's all done for you and streamed to you over an internet connection. So in that respect, you know, they're low maintenance. And the reason why they're cheaper is they're not having to pay for a Windows license, first of all, which costs money, but also the hardware required to run what is in effect a browser is much less than is required to efficiently run a full Windows operating system. So I would think about that. And if you're not completely happy with that, I would actually take it back and ask for something else and point out that it was effectively, well, I won't use the word as you've named the company, but that you weren't perhaps made fully aware of the fundamental difference of that machine with others. Did you pay by credit card by any point?
No, I didn't. Mm.
Okay, so I'll say this as a comment maybe for other people. Your rights of return on these sorts of purchases are much better if you purchased at a distance, that's to say either online or even over the phone or by mail order even. And you have further rights if you've made a purchase on... did you make it on a debit card or did you pay cash?
Yeah, on my debit card, yeah.
Okay, so in the past... the only protection that consumers had was if they paid by credit card because they were protected under something called the Consumer Credit Act, where the credit card company was equally liable for the transaction and therefore the way something was sold as the vendor themselves. So you can use that, for example, if you pay for something and then the company goes bust before they provide you with the goods, but they've taken the money, you can get a refund equally if you had a legitimate consumer complaint. What the card company, credit card company, can do is refund you your money, and then they can get the money back off their customer, who is the vendor. Now, it used to be the case that was the only real protection you'd have on cards is if it was a credit card. However, a lot of banks have now introduced a very similar system for debit card purchases. So if you need to act quickly because three months is quite close to the sort of 30-day or 28-day. So I would contact them in the morning, essentially, and say to them, you know, you're not happy with this, and if indeed you are not happy, and that you want to return it for ideally for a refund. If they don't play ball, very quickly get onto the issuer of the card with which you paid and see what their scheme is to support consumers. And there are schemes that are similar in practice to what you can get now with credit cards, but don't rely on it because it's not as all-encompassing as for credit cards, but it does now exist, and there's a good chance that your purchase may also be covered by that if the particular vendor doesn't want to play ball with you. But generally speaking, I'd hate to think that a vendor has sold someone a Chromebook without explaining to them that it's not the same.
It's quite fundamentally different, isn't it?
It is very fundamentally different. And for some things, you know, like, for example, in school environments or for people who want to share documents and have groups of people working on the same document at once, you know, that works very well on Chromebooks, although you can also achieve the same thing with PCs. But PCs are more expensive, so hence some Chromebooks tend to be popular in schools. Yeah.
Well, a few options there for June. And if you've got questions for Fevzi, we've got plenty of time to get them to him. 0500 909 693, or you can text 85058.
This is BBC Five Live, available on the BBC iPlayer radio app. Up all night.
And this is Callum McDonald with you at 2:37, and it's my pleasure to say that Fevzi Turkalp's with us, the gadget detective. And Fevzi, we've had quite a few texts come in, so let's just get through some of these. First of all, Andy from Warrington wants to know if it's possible for him to change his wireless router's password. He says he's with Virgin. It's a Virgin router he's got.
So the short answer is yes, it is possible. Bear in mind that there are two different passwords that could be being referred to here. One is the password that secures the wireless transmissions and reception that it makes. So that's your Wi-Fi password. And that you can and should definitely change because if you're using any sort of default password for that, then obviously that's not ideal. That can be changed. You normally go... So the way you normally change the settings on a router is that you plug a computer into it using an internet cable, so you don't connect to it via Wi-Fi. Ideally, you use it a cable. And then you go to your router's configuration page. So that's a page of settings that appears within your browser. So you might type, instead of typing the name of a web address, you might type in, you know, 123.456.789. Whatever, and then your configuration page will start. From there, you can enter the router's username and password. You can open up the wireless section and change the password there. You can make sure you've got the right sort of security. So, for example, WPA2 as opposed to WEP. You can change pretty much everything from there, and you should do. So that's one password, the Wi-Fi password. Then you've got the password of the router itself, and that's what's required so that you can get into the settings page. So that, again, would be a good idea to change for security. But that's more of a risk for people who've actually got access to your router. But you should change both and make sure that you choose things that are secure. One more tip that I would give you: when a router broadcasts a Wi-Fi signal, it also broadcasts an identifier of itself, something called an SSID, and that will normally say, oh, you know, it's a Netgear model, whatever, or what have you. It's worth changing that, because if anyone is trying to hack into your internet via your router, you don't even want to give them the clue of what router that you're using. And the best thing to do is just change it to the name of a completely different brand of router, or something that just doesn't refer to a router itself. And from a security point of view, change the brand and model name to a different router, so that they it's not just that they know that you've changed it, they don't even realize you've changed it and may waste valuable time and effort trying to hack into a router that you don't own. Those are the little tweaks that you should do. You should always change those passwords, make sure that they are not those chosen by the manufacturer, and make sure that they're not guessable. So that, you know, usually involves uppercase and lowercase letters, numerics, and if it will allow you, non-alphabetic characters as well.
Yeah. 0500 909 693 is the phone number, and 85058 on the text. Spike in Glastonbury asks, very simply, how do I access Amazon Prime programmes when I receive my TV through a Sky Plus HD box?
I Well, Sky is a rival service, so the Sky box, I don't think, will allow you to run an Amazon app on it. So there are different ways of achieving this. If, for example, you have a smartphone or a tablet, you can often, well, you can certainly access it that way, or almost any sort of desktop computer. Also, if you have, if you own an Amazon Fire TV box or an Amazon Fire Stick, which I think, you know, you can buy an Amazon Fire Stick for around £35, and that will give you a lot more content. Although, if you are in the market for a sort of streaming device, my advice would be not to go for the Stick, but to go for the box, because that will allow you not only internet connection to movies via Wi-Fi, but also via wired connection, which is more robust and reliable than Wi-Fi in general. The other thing that you can do is you can often, if you have any sort of smart box already attached to your TV, is you can use, say, the mobile phone or the tablet to receive a movie, and then you can cast it on to the desktop. And if you don't have anything like that, you can get a little Google Stick quite affordably, plug it into one of the spare HDMI sockets on the back of a computer, on the back of your TV set, and you can do it that way. So there's a variety of ways. You either run it on a box that's attached to the TV, or you cast the content from a mobile device onto the TV.
We'll do some more text in just a minute, but first, Chris in Dunipace. Hello, Chris.
Hi there.
And what would you like to ask Fevzi this morning?
I've just received a new SIM card from a provider, and it's got a contactless payment on it. I just want to know how secure the contactless payment on the SIM card is.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's not completely secure, and people have already published proof of concepts of ways of getting around the security that they have. The protections are commercial. The protections for you are commercial as much as technical. There are technical protections, but the fact is, if you drop a contactless card and someone picks it up, they can start making payments with it. But if a series of transactions starts to occur, an unusual transaction occurs, it will require the person who's got the card to enter the PIN number, and that sometimes happens. So you may find it, when you start using the card, every few goes, it may say, particularly if it's a new vendor, they may say, now, okay, you've presented the card as contactless, but now swipe the card or push the card into the device and enter the four-digit PIN. The other protection is, and depending on the card issuer, there are some limitations that the card issuers provide. There's usually a limitation on the maximum value of an individual transaction, which can be typically £25 or £30. But there's also a limitation in how much you can spend with a vendor and how much you can spend on a day. Different card companies do that differently. Unfortunately, it's kind of difficult to get the cards without the contactless on them. Some banks do issue them, but not all. If you ask for it, they can do it if you're adamant that you don't want it. Another way forward, for users of Apple phones, there's something called Apple Pay, which is effectively a digital wallet where you can upload your plastic into the phone, in effect, and then use the contact by present the phone to the contactless terminal instead. Now, why would you do this, and why can that be more secure? Well, with Apple Pay, the way it works, so when you make a normal card transaction, the vendor gets all your card details and they can store them, and if later they are hacked, your card details may become subject to theft. However, when you make a payment with Apple Pay, the system works differently. First of all, you've uploaded your card details into a phone, and forgive me if you don't own an Apple phone. There are other payment systems as well, but arguably not quite so secure. So I'm concentrating on what Apple do as a sort of a best solution available at the moment, in my view. So the first thing is, those details are protected by either a PIN number to unlock the phone or your fingerprint. Yes, if you've got a fingerprint reader, does that. So first of all, that protects you. So even someone who wanted to use a phone, if you drop your phone, they can't use it contactless in the same way as they could use the actual card, because they're going to have to unlock the phone to get that to work. So that's one thing. The other thing is, when you make a purchase via Apple Pay, then the vendor doesn't get the same information about you and your card that they would normally get when you pay using the physical card itself. What they get is effectively a promise. You know, like a banknote is a promissory note. I promise to pay the bearer such and such amount of money. It's the same sort of idea. It's a token. They get a token, which means that they get paid, but they don't get your information. And therefore, they can't store your information. And therefore, if they're hacked, or should I say when they're hacked, your information isn't there to be stolen. So in that sense, sort of somewhat counterintuitively, loading your card details into, say, an iPhone, it can be arguably, and I think is, more secure than using the cards themselves. So you've always got the option of locking up the cards if you're an iPhone user. Now, there is Android Pay and there is Samsung Pay. They have some of those benefits, but I don't think they work in quite the same way, and I think the security model is not quite as robust. But, those are options as well. But as far as the contactless is concerned, it's always this balance, and this balance comes up in almost every area of life, but it's this balance between convenience and security stroke privacy. The more convenient something is, the less secure it is. So it's very convenient to be able to tap a card. You know, you want to make a small purchase, you don't want to enter your PIN, you can't remember your PIN, it's not convenient, but it is arguably more secure. It's a bit like your computer. Wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to have passwords on everything? It would be very convenient, but it would be very insecure. That's the balance. And with contactless payments, they are convenient, but arguably they are less secure.
Chris, do you feel a little bit more reassured about possibly using your contactless payment now?
Yeah, definitely.
That's good. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for ringing, Chris. Good to speak to you. Cheers now. Febsy, a couple more texts. This one from Lloyd in Bridgend in South Wales. A couple of questions. He says, can I or should I have any kind of antivirus programs for my PS4, my PlayStation 4, to protect me when I'm online gaming?
That's a very good question. It used to be the case that you didn't need antivirus for anything. I think on a PS4... not so much with viruses, but what you need to do is you need to be aware and not provide more information via the PS4 about yourself than you need to do. So if you provide, you know, payment information, you must be aware of the fact that, you know, you are providing that, and there is some potentially a risk. And Sony were very famously hacked more than once, in very high profile hacks going back a number of years. And so, for example, when you enter information about yourself, I can't say what you should do, but what some people do is they change their personal information in such a way that information can't then be used for identity fraud and so forth. So, yeah. Sometimes, and this applies also when you're, you know, entering stuff onto websites on, you know, PCs or Macs or any portable device. When you sign up for a service, they often ask you for information. Now, it's often in the terms and conditions of the website that you give real information. But I have to say that if it's not an actual transaction where you're buying something and you have to identify yourself, then some people do use, you know, variations of their actual data. I know of people who've changed their age or their gender or the spelling of their name or their name completely. And if it's just something where, you know, they're just gathering data because they want to gather data, but it's not really critical for the purpose that you've signed onto the website for, then it's not usually illegal to do that. It's just usually against the terms of service of a website. So if they were to consider that you'd done that, they could kick you off their service, but usually it wouldn't go further than that. Okay. But that's often a good thing to do. But as far as the PS4 is concerned, I think your options are very limited in terms of loading security software on it. What you need to do is just be aware of what information you're providing and provide the minimum. And where possible, don't choose the option where it allows them to save payment data onto a particular service, because again, once your payment data is on their system, it's vulnerable to being hacked.
Okay, we'll sneak in Lloyd's second question as well. What can I do to record gameplay when I stream on Twitch through my PS4?
Okay, so there are a number of devices that you can buy specifically for the purpose of recording. So these devices will capture the video stream of gameplay. It can be other things as well. You can use these boxes for setting up a small, you know, streaming TV station even. This is a small box about the size of a bar of soap. There's a good company called Elgato that make very good ones, Elgato. Other brands do exist, but Elgato are ones that I've used quite extensively. Okay. And trust. And what that will do is it will attach to, say, your games console, PS4 or otherwise, and then it will allow you, it will capture that stream, the audio and video, and it will send that to a computer, so, you know, typically a desktop PC or indeed a laptop, and allow it to capture the audio and the video. And there's a couple of tricks that they do as well. Let's say you want to record gameplay, but you might want to be talking about that gameplay, and you have a webcam and you're streaming you talking about it, maybe you're in the corner of the screen, it would allow you to do that as well. So you can record yourself via the webcam, your audio, the audio and picture of the game itself on separate channels, and dump it all into a PC, and you can stream it at the same time, but you can also record it. So I'd look at those. Just be aware that those devices exist in different forms with different inputs on them, depending upon your needs. So some of them would have what's called an HDMI input, which is a digital audio-visual input, which you're probably familiar with because most TV sets now have HDMI sockets on them. But at the same time, you get ones that might have the more old-fashioned type of connectors, which might be, if you've got, let's say, a PlayStation 3 or an older generation console, then you'd make sure you buy the box with the right inputs on it. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Let's go to Chris in Liverpool. Good morning, Chris.
All right, Jay, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. And I think you want to ask a question about your phone.
Yes. I'm with one of the smaller companies, and my reception's very bad, but 100 yards from my front door is a four-storey gymnasium. It's a complete metal structure,
yep.
All heavyweight girders. And with all the machinery in there, the electrical machinery, would that interfere with me reception?
It's unlike. How far away is it from your?
Approximately 100 yards, maybe a little bit less.
It's unlikely to be that because electromagnetic interference dies off quite rapidly with distance. It goes. It goes with the square of the distance. So if you double the distance, it's a quarter of the strength. If you treble the distance, it's a ninth of the strength. And so those signals tend to fall away quite quickly. Yeah. That's not to say that, first of all, any sort of structure can interfere with the signal because it can physically block the signal, particularly if the structure contains a lot of metal. It's very good because the way in which, for example, if you wanted to shield your home from all signals, you know, if you're one of these people who wants to wear a sort of tin hat, as it were, you would build into the walls of your home what's called a Faraday cage, which is like a metal mesh. If you look at a microwave oven, for example, why is it that we don't get zapped by microwaves that fly out of the microwave oven and hit us? The reason is because there's a Faraday cage, metal cage, built into the oven. And the way you can actually see that is if you look at carefully at the glass door of a microwave oven, you will see that in the glass, or just attached to the glass, is a small mesh. And that mesh is actually stopping the microwave signals, which are, you know, electromagnetic signals, in principle the same as for a mobile phone, although differing in energy, it's stopping those from passing through. So in a similar way, a metal structure can, any structure, but particularly a metal structure, can interfere with mobile phone and other similar signals. The other problem that you may be having, so there's a number of issues here, you may find that either devices in your own home or your neighbor's homes, if you've got neighbors very close, if for example you're in a flat or you're in a house with, you know, neighbors on the other side of the walls, yeah, and above and below, their internet signals, their Wi-Fi signals can interfere. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you can look at doing is to change the channel that your router is operating on. So to try and get away from interference. Imagine if Nextdoor's router is working on the same channel and frequency as yours, they may interfere. We mentioned earlier how you can log on to the settings page of a router. Once you have logged on by attaching a computer to the router, one of the things you can change is the channel, and you can just experiment by flipping the channels and seeing if your reception improves at all. Bear in mind, other devices like cordless phones and baby monitors, they can also interfere.
Yeah.
So you might just try doing a bit of a digital detox in your house, turning everything off and seeing if any of that makes a difference, anything that transmits.
I haven't got anything on. I'm a caveman.
Yeah. I haven't got
a telly or anything.
Yeah. But the answer to your original question is yes. You know, nearby buildings can have an effect, but also you get dead spots that are for other reasons. It can be just because you know, the network that you're using doesn't have you know, a good signal from the local cell tower. It may be weak, or it may not be very close. Yeah. It may be that you live in an area which is, you know, there's a dip in the land, and actually the signal is being blocked by you know, surrounding territory.
Possible.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this is when you're getting a mobile phone, there is the theory and the practice. The theory is you check the coverage map from the mobile phone provider, and you check the coverage map before the purchase from Ofcom. They have a map of their own, and it will tell you what sort of signal you should be able to expect. Now, I can tell you that although that's an indication, it can be wildly wrong. And I myself had this problem where I got a mobile phone contract. I was given to understand I'd get something like 4 to 5 bars of signal. In reality, I got 0 to 1 bar and had to hand back the contract because of it. Now, you do have the ability to hand back contracts when that happens, but different mobile phone networks can often perform differently. So it's often worth, before committing to a contract, to either trying a pay-as-you-go type SIM, to just without committing to a contract to try it out, or to see how your friends' phones do at your location as well. And if they do substantially better, it might be worth considering their network instead of the one that you're on.
There you go, Chris. I understand nothing more frustrating than bad phone signal, especially at home. I have that problem when I go home and visit my family. The phone signal just drops off a cliff. It's absolutely horrendous.